So Jung's work has been really, really influential for me in both, one, helping see reality as it is, see the truth in so many great traditions in their core. And then two, recognize where, you know, the culture that I live in has become neurotic, where it's forced so many of us to shove the good parts of ourselves into our shadows. And it's separated us, the very eros that we're talking about that lets us walk the plank, that lets us make an erotic decision. Western culture tries to program out of us. And Jung was really helpful in psychological language about talking about how to bring that back in. How do I get in touch with the parts of myself that I've lost? How do I get in touch with the passion that I've lost? How do I get in touch with my inner divinity, right?
The conversation does not stop. It shape shifts, it deepens, it dances on the edge of what we thought we knew. Welcome to the Free Radical Podcast. Once again, space where questions burn together brighter than answers. And reality is not a destination, but a living dialogue. Today, I spoke with Mike Petra, a Christian thinker, scholar, and Jungian specialist. He's a close friend of Father Richard Rohr, and now a dear brother and friend of mine as well, and someone deeply engaged with the intersection of psychology, theology, and contemplative life. Mike Petra serves as the Director of Formation, Faculty Relations, and Theological Foundations at the Center for Action and Contemplation, sometimes known as the CAC. The CAC is a nonprofit founded by Father Richard Rohr that introduces seekers to the contemplative Christian path of transformation. Mike is intimately involved with the CAC's Living School, a core educational offering from the CAC that last year offered a course called Essentials of Engaged Contemplation. Mike is one of the primary hosts in the conversations that make up much of the program, often conversing with people like Richard Rohr and Brian McLaren. In addition to his work at the CAC, Mike Petra works as a spiritual director. He holds degrees, including a PhD in psychology, mythology, and religious studies. It was a vibrant, momentous sharing with Mike. We talked about many things. His relationship with Father Richard Rohr, of course, the notion of everything belongs, risk-taking in love, our fear of our brightest potential, his love for origin, and the dynamics of union and separation in our connection with the divine, his love for Carl Jung, the shadow, how to befriend our shadow, and whatever else you can imagine existing in between each of these topics. So please come to the table. This is the Free Radical Podcast. And to support it, please subscribe by clicking on the bell. And if you feel inspired, called, nourished by the conversation, like it, share it, drop your comments to keep our dialogue ongoing, an eternal learning and eternal unfolding of ever-evolving reality. So without further ado, dear brothers and sisters, here is Mike Petra. Dear Mike, thank you so much for joining us in the Free Radical Podcast. Big honor, big pleasure, big everything to have you here today.
Oh my gosh, what a gift, Swami. It's so great to see your face again, to get to have a conversation. I feel like after many, many months, maybe years of trying, we've had the gift of three wonderful conversations in 2 weeks' time. How amazing. Mm-hmm.
We are being spoiled for sure.
Yeah. What a tremendous treasure chest of wisdom and joy we've been able to pass back and forth between the two of us and Taos with Amelia as well. What a gift.
May I say goodness gracious.
Goodness
following
gracious.
Your footsteps.
Goodness gracious, indeed. Funny thing. So when we were hanging out in Taos, I said goodness gracious and you said, oh, I've heard you say that on the podcast. I didn't realize I said it till you pointed it out. And now I'm thinking about it. And I go, gosh, I do say it all the time.
You say it a lot, yeah. But it's second nature, so you won't notice that you're saying that's the ideal way. So
don't even realize that I'll take it.
So yeah, I like somehow to start some of my episodes reminding my audience or reminding myself how I met each of the guests I'm bringing to the conversation. And I think in the case of you, of course, I get to know you first online by listening to some of the podcasts and services you are performing, the Certain Time for Action and Contemplation. And last year I was in Albuquerque for a retreat that I was generally invited, and we just crossed sides and maybe greeted one another just officially, but you were too busy those days, so perfectly understood. We didn't have time to interact, but I was really willing to do so. Yeah. And as you say, a few weeks ago, maybe 2 weeks maximum, we were in Taos. We shared a very beautiful afternoon together with you, your partner Amelia, Daniel Ladinsky, surprise guest for a moment.
I know, over chocolate cake, right? What a twist.
Yeah. And some days ago, I had the pleasure of being invited by you to your podcast, yeah. Healer with a Thousand Faces, and you're been invited to mine. So, yeah. And whatever we spoke so far, it was so interesting that I'm even thinking about bringing some of the things we already explored that day or these last days and continue.
Oh, great.
Exploring them as they are endless in nature, right?
That's so wonderful. Yeah, it was such a joy. I remember when you were with us at that retreat a year or two ago. I think it was about a year ago last spring. And we kept being on opposite sides of the room. I would see you across the room. And then I remember at one point as the retreat was almost over, I saw you. We have this beautiful tree on the grounds of the Center for Action and Contemplation that Richard has written quite a bit about, the Trinity Tree, he calls it, because it's this old cottonwood that twists into three gigantic branching out beautiful trunks that kind of canopy over the property. And I remember just seeing you. I don't know if you were practicing or just taking it all in, but I saw you out under the tree and I thought, gosh, we never got a chance to talk. And then sure enough, a few days later, you sent an email and said, hey, we never got a chance to speak, but it'd be wonderful to have a conversation. And it took us about a year to make it happen. But I'm so glad, you know, to anyone listening, we talk about this on my podcast, but I think this episode will come out first. I was at the International Thomas Merton Society Conference in Denver. And as the conference was ending, my phone rang and it was our beloved friend Richard Rohr. So I dashed outside to make sure that everything was okay, because Richard usually calls if he needs something. And he just raved about what a beautiful conversation he'd had with you and said, do whatever you need to do to make sure that you get to spend some time with Swami. And gosh, he's not wrong. What a gift. So glad we're here.
Well, he told me the same thing to me about you. He's not wrong, I must say. So
yeah. Oh,
pleasure to be honoring Richard's advice and having these beautiful exchanges with you. And since we mentioned Richard, let me begin with something close to the heart and probably where everyone in my audience will like to go first, including me.
Yeah.
Which is your relationship with Richard Rohr. You've worked with him closely at the CAC for what, 10 years or more now?
Well, so it's been a journey. So I would say starting about 15 or 16 years ago, people started putting Richard on my radar and telling me to read his books. I think the very first time someone gave me one of Richard's books, it was 2009. And to be very honest, Swami, I was sort of on a journey and I was studying a lot of Taoism and Buddhism and Hinduism and Jungian psychology especially. And I'd sort of walked away from my inherited faith tradition as a Christian. And someone gave me Richard's book, The Naked Now. And they said, this is a book about non-duality from a great Christian mystical teacher. And I really think this is going to help you integrate a lot of things in your journey. And I remember, this is a true story. It was my spiritual director. She gave me the book. I left the spiritual direction session. I got in my car and I threw the book in my back seat and thought, what do I care about what a Christian has to say about non-duality? And then I didn't pick the book up for a few years. But when I did, when Richard finally really got onto my radar, I heard him on a podcast and I kept hearing about him and people kept saying, he's going to be your teacher. He's your guy. He's interested in all the things you're interested in. He's going to help you go further. And I finally heard him on a podcast, and immediately the first time I heard him speak, I knew this was a teacher who was sort of cooking in the kitchen with the ingredients that I wanted to cook with, but he'd been doing it a lot longer. and he was putting some really beautiful meals together. So I
Master Chef.
Oh, just absolutely. And so I, on a whim, enrolled in what's called the Living School, which is a big flagship spiritual formation program that the Center for Action and Contemplation still offers now as the Essentials of Engaged Contemplation course. And I got accepted, which was great. I didn't know. Back then, it was like 1 in 10 folks would get accepted. Mm. And I ended up at the first big symposium. And sorry for the long story, but I ended up at the first big symposium. And I was there with hundreds of people. And Richard was there on stage. And on the very last day, as it was quiet, I walked around a corner. And I saw Richard standing in a hallway. And I just walked up to him and said, hey, I don't want to bother you. I just want to shake your hand and say that your teaching has been really meaningful to me. And he said, hang on. Tell me, where are you from? Who are you? What are you interested in? And so we ended up talking. And he asked what I did. And I talked to him about my work with Origin of Alexandria and Carl Jung. And he said, hang on. You're interesting. Let's talk. And we sort of struck up a friendship. So I was in the Living School from 2016 to 2018. Mm. And then in 2019, because my background is comparative religious studies and Jungian psychology and a few other things, I've been to a few seminaries here and there, I got recruited by the center to start doing some writing for them. And then since 2019, I've had various different roles here, but always some version of working with the teachers to help them put content out in the world. That's been a gift. And now, you know, I'll say this and be done. About 5 years ago, mm-hmm. I was given the gift of my job was to go to Richard's house every Tuesday afternoon and have a check-in with him. And we started having these really wonderful conversations about the spiritual life. And then Paul Swanson started joining us. And after 2 or 3 years of doing that, we thought, gosh, we should figure out a way to bring other folks into this living room with us and just have these amazing conversations we get to have where Richard is just casually sharing wisdom with us. And that's where the Everything Belongs podcast was born. Was literally, we thought, let's just bring a microphone in. And and we did, and we still do every Tuesday afternoon.
Such a hard job you have to do, right? Every weekly basis meeting Richard in his hermitage. Yeah.
There are other parts that are hard, but yeah,
I didn't want to skip that. That's the part I do for free.
It's pretty great.
Yeah. So you've shared really much sacred space with Richard. So yeah. I'm wondering if you would like to share with us what has this relationship with you throughout the years taught you, especially I'm thinking about the ideal ways of being a mentor and being a student. In my opinion, for me, like, I don't know, Richard, I consider him an ideal mentor, an ideal elder. So what has been the lessons for you from receiving from an ideal mentor and for you as a student of that ideal mentor?
I would say that's a really good question, Swami. I appreciate it. I feel like we are all on this journey from student to teacher to elder to ancestor. You know, we're all somewhere in there, and not all of us will end up podcasting or writing books, but all of us, you know, are students and we learn, right? This is what you and I talked about on my podcast. Our wounds and our wonder, they show us our wandering, they set us off on our life path, they give us our wondering, the questions that are ours to ask and answer, they help us find our wisdom, and then the wisdom that we find for ourselves is our wisdom to give to the world. But they also help us find our wisdom teachers. And I think in that, Richard, first of all, has modeled that journey for me because he's an elder at this point and it won't be long before he's an ancestor. But he's always been a student. Richard has always been a student. He's been a student of life. He's been a student of scripture. He's been a student of his teacher, St. Francis. He's been a student of all the teachers that come around him, and he's been a student of the natural world and the synchronicities that take place around him. So that, I think that was the first big gift, was realizing that the true teacher and the true mentor is always a student themselves, and they just invite you into their curiosity and their learning journey. Does that make sense?
Totally, yeah. And I really appreciate you mentioned that, because when you mentioned this sequence, you mentioned what? Student, teacher, elder, ancestor.
Yeah.
And when you say that, first of all, I really appreciated that unfolding, but also I thought but the student part always remains and even like deepens the more exactly. you get closer to the other departments, so to say.
Exactly.
I really appreciate that you started with highlighting that, because that's our teaching, our traditions. One of my teachers will say, we are students forever.
Yeah.
That's kind of his one-liner, students forever.
Oh, I love that so much.
Mm-hmm.
Richard's my great living teacher right now. My great dead teacher, my great ancestor teacher is Origen of Alexandria. And he says that, you know, he says that curiosity is a gift given to us by the divine, and it's a form of love. And as such, the great you, and I've talked about this before, it's what I love about our conversations is they live in this place where the most important matters call for dialogue, not definition, and exploration, not explanation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only been in the last few years that I've realized my really great teachers like Richard, Jim Finley would be another example, Dr. Barbara Holmes, who recently crossed from elder to ancestor, a very deep, profound example in my life. They were always just sharing their curiosity.
Mirabai's star, why not?
Oh my God, Mirabai's. Yes.
I had to bring her into the table.
No, Mirabai might be my favorite of all of them. So no offense to anyone listening. I just love Mirabai so much. But yes, Mirabai's another good example. She's someone who invites us, as you do, Swami, into the questions that are her particular quest. And in so doing that, it makes space for our questions. Right? And I think that's...
I really appreciate that. Sorry to interrupt. Appreciate that, because I always say, and I'm not comparing myself with Mirabai. I'm not in any way close to that, nor anyone. It's one is in their own journey. But I would think I cannot write about anything that is not my journey. I mean, yeah. I cannot just professionally, okay, please, Swami, write the book about this theme.
Yeah.
It has to be a very passionate inner quest. And by me embodying that quest and journey allows others to have their voice in that journey. So I really appreciate that point.
I appreciate that. In the depth psychology field, that's my background, there's a saying that every theory is a subjective confession, right? And so we used to joke and say, you know, tell me what you think about humanity and I'll tell you a little bit about your life story. And originally that idea came in to try to keep us honest. To recognize again, when I talk about the healer with a thousand faces and I talk about our wounds giving us our wandering and our wondering and our wisdom, that's my story coming through. I used to think that was a detriment, and I was always trying to be more subjective and more universal. And I've come to realize there's no getting outside of it, right? And like you just said, you know, the medicine that's ours to seek is the medicine that we need. And then that's the medicine that we're most equipped, I think, to share with folks around us. Mine is different than yours. Yours is different than Mirabai's. Mirabai's is different than Richard's. But it's that passionate quest for it that calls us forward. I had an old Irish mentor who used to say, I can't do his Irish accent anymore. It's been too many years since we spoke. But he would always say that.
Right. A little bit.
I can't. He'll do it. I'm going to get it so bad. We say the pain. No, can't do it. The pain that you can feel. I can't do the accent, but I can do his gravelly voice. The pain that you can feel is the pain that you can heal, right? And this idea that the pain that we feel is one, what a gift. When you feel pain, you give it attention, and therefore you will give it the attention it needs to heal. But then also when you do the healing work with it, that then helps you to heal others. Anyway, sorry for rambling. I get excited about this, Swami. It's beautiful stuff.
That's how it works. Yeah. And I'm going in a minute to your podcast and the Healer with a Thousand Faces, to Origin, great. To Jung. We are going there.
Yeah.
But one more thing in connection to Richard that comes to my mind and related to the podcast you are doing. He has a book, for those who don't know, which is one of his masterpieces.
Yeah.
Every book is one of those, which is Everything Belongs.
Yeah.
You're conducting a podcast under that same title. Yeah. And for me, that not only the book, but the phrase, those two words, Everything Belongs, say a lot. Even if I once thought, even if this whole book will just say Everything Belongs in its cover and you open and all the pages are blank.
Yeah.
Still, I have enough Lectio Divina to do for three lifetimes only with those two words, Everything Belongs.
Yeah.
So I don't know. You can, and once it came to me, this idea with everything belongs, came another part that came, you own nothing, you belong to everything.
Oh, Swami, that's good. You own nothing, you belong to everything. I love that.
Yeah, because sometimes we are on an acquiring journey.
Yes.
And the more we have with thing, the more I become, right? Yes. The more my sense of possessiveness extends, the more sense of identity, I feel it expands. But at the end of the day, we own nothing. So where is our dignity? You belong to everything. Everything belongs. So.
Yeah. Well, and we see, and more on that in a second, but I just want to appreciate what you're saying and sit with it for a moment because it's so helpful for me. I think something that I've been wondering about lately is, you know, living in a culture where I'm programmed to, one, to amass as much of everything as I can. Two, to believe that the next purchase or the next thing that's missing is the thing that's finally going to make me happy.
Mm-hmm.
And three, in realizing that it seems like the more we acquire, the more we want.
Yeah.
Whereas on the flip side, right, the more we let go, the more content we are.
Yeah. Because the more we let go, the more we acknowledge that we already belong and that our sense of being is not based on feeling that we are the owners of anything, but understanding that we already we belong. You know? So,
I love that. Well, I
know it can sound shocking and I can sound too much of a monk saying you own nothing. But sometimes we need a little bit those shocking one-liners to be sobered in our, as you say, our obsessive pursuit of things and this mirage that the next one thing will finally make it, and it never happens from that place. Yeah.
No. And I think it's so liberating to realize that, because the tyranny of acquisition, right? Mm-hmm. There's a really wonderful and very entertaining teacher out there named Kate Bowler. And I heard her once, and to anyone who's a fan, please forgive me. I'm going to horrendously paraphrase this, but I heard her say something in paraphrase that equated like sort of Western spirituality at the popular level to, you know, you're just one step away from having your best life now. And it's this idea that there's always just one more thing that you need to do. And if you do that one more thing, that new workout, that new supplement, that new spiritual book, that new course, that new practice, that new just getting your attachment style just right, whatever it is, then you'll finally be happy. And I think about, you're asking about Richard saying everything belongs. That title has been a stumbling block for a lot of people, including me, because it can feel like it's saying, you know, everything's all good and there's no suffering in the world and we shouldn't work to make love more real or to correct injustice. But this idea instead, you know, I've said to Richard a bunch of times, if everything belongs, why does it have to hurt so bad? You know, all the time. But this idea that getting out of that I just have to do this next thing and then it'll finally be good enough. Richard, my favorite thing he's ever said is when he says the only perfection available to us is our ability to accept and love our imperfection, right?
Amen.
Or even, you know, for me, if sometimes I think the only wholeness available to me is to love and accept my incompleteness.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how I take everything belongs for me. It's all about like integration and whatever brokenness and suffering and pain still is taking place in a bigger, deeper and wider vessel of unconditional love, which is the ultimate vessel that contains it all and that includes, does not exclude, all imperfectional brokenness.
Yeah. And there's a, you know, while you and I are talking, it's a hard time in the world, which it seems like it always is. I have people that I care about in the hospital. I have friends who are struggling, friends that have recently had people that they care about pass away. These things are all real. And my accepting them, like acceptance isn't approval, right? Mm-hmm. My accepting the reality of them does not mean that I don't also accept the heartbreak and the injustice that's a part of it. But when I accept it, then I'm dealing with reality, And when I'm dealing with reality, instead of being trapped in the fantasy of how it should be different, mm-hmm. when I'm dealing with reality, then I can also accept where I can actually step in and bring love to a situation and make a real difference. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And as much I'm thinking as we are willing to accept and integrate, not just merely, as you say, approve, but acceptance is an integration, a confrontation to put in front of you what was behind you.
Yeah.
And the challenge there is for me also so much to grieve, as you were saying, as I was mentioning to you the other day. I'm reading this one, The Wild Days of Sorrow. Oh. And that speaks so much about grieving, the need for grief. And so we have so many things to grieve, not only in our personal life, our ancestry, the world at large, nature, every department you can think of, there is something to grieve there. But he will say you have also to balance that with being grateful for so many beautiful things that are still coming in the context of that, because if we just zoom in into grief as the exclusive reality, it's too much. So keeping in balance and seeing everything, holding space for everything, that for me what I'm understanding as acceptance, right?
And I think that's really, I appreciate you saying that, because I think what, you know, when Richard talks a lot about accepting reality and forgiving reality, and that is also a stumbling block for a lot of people, because again, they think that acceptance is approval. What helped me was when I thought about it in the language of grief, because as you know, I've had a lot of death in my personal journey. I lost my mom and my brother 6 months apart. I lost a friend in elementary school, one of my best friends in high school. I've had two mentors who've just passed away unexpectedly at really pivotal points in my life, and so on and so forth. And I work with all these beautiful elder teachers who are transitioning now into becoming ancestors. So there's a lot of death ahead of me as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things they talk about in the grieving process is coming to a place of acceptance. There's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross uses the language of the stages of grief, and it's a very simple starter framework. And I know that, but when she talks about denial, anger, sadness, bargaining, acceptance, which happen, you know, in whatever particular order they happen in, I think a lot about acceptance doesn't necessarily mean that I'm okay with the fact that I have lost someone, but it does mean that I'm living with the reality of it, and I'm no longer trapped in the fantasy of, you know, only thinking about how it shouldn't have happened and how different my life would be if it hadn't happened. Because you can only heal in reality, right?
Yeah,
you can only heal in reality,
and somehow even being courageous and willing to rediscover your relationship with that person you've lost through the loss, through the pain and through whatever is accepted, there is a wound, open wound there, and that's in one sense a portal to a new relationship with that same person, right?
Yeah, 100%, 100%, and that's the reality of it. So it's I think when I have accepted the loss of people that I care about, and also situations that I care about, jobs that I care about, relationships that I care about that came to an end. When I accept the loss of it, then suddenly it becomes present to me in a different way, right? Mm-hmm. I genuinely believe that the folks that have passed on as ancestors are very present to me in a very real way, spiritually and in this reality. Yeah. But I also think the wisdom of things that I let go of, right? Mm-hmm. Seasons of life, when I accept that they're over, they become a different kind of a gift to me.
Yeah.
But you've got to go through that very difficult portal of acceptance. Goodness gracious.
Yeah. And paradoxically, when you do that, in one sense, you realize there is no, in my opinion, there is no ultimate loss. Whatever you lost and you went through just becomes present in a deeper way, in a new way. So in one sense, you haven't lost that. You have lost a certain version of it, which can even happen with versions of your religion, so to say, you need to let go, shed that skin, and you have to grieve that loss. But when you do that properly, you are met with a new, deeper, broader version of that tradition, and that with everything and anything.
It's one more version of accepting the imperfection of reality, and meeting God there and ourselves there. You know, to bring it full circle, when you asked me about learning and getting to be, you know, a student, a close student of Richard's. He's like a spiritual mm-hmm. grandpa at this point. I once heard an Eastern Orthodox priest who frequently visited Mount Athos, which is one of the great spiritual centers of Hesychastic Christianity. And he was talking about the spiritual fathers on Mount Athos. And he said, when you see a truly healthy spiritual father and you see their students, regardless of their age, he said, what you see is permission to become children in the presence of the spiritual father, right? And I will mm-hmm. honestly say, like, one of the gifts of my relationship with Richard is I do feel a permission to be imperfect in his presence. Mm-hmm. And he is willing to be imperfect in my presence, which I appreciate. And what I've come to realize, reflecting back on that statement from that Eastern Orthodox priest, is that that imperfection is a childlike state. Because we don't ever think of children as being imperfect, but they are very messy, right? And if we could give ourselves the same permission to be messy.
Very vulnerable, I would like to say. Yeah. Also, I will say that part of what attracts us to children and babies is, and even without knowing, is how vulnerable they are.
Oh, that's really good. Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
We may think, oh, it's such a cute baby I love, but why I'm so drawn to the baby and not to an adult also, because the baby has no filter, again, his messiness, imperfection, vulnerability. So,
yeah. Yeah.
And there's both the Bible and even our tradition say the end goal is to become childlike, right? Not childish, childlike.
I love that. And I feel like you said to me the other day that it's better to be I'm going to paraphrase, but it's better to be our own authentic mess than it is to be someone else's perfection.
Did I get that right? That's one section. That's one section from the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says to Arjuna, you better perform your dharma, your duty, imperfectly, that someone else is perfectly. So that was my reading of that. Yeah,
that's so good. That's so good, because I think a lot of times, I think we spend a lot of our lives trying to master someone else's perfection.
Yeah, probably that's one of the ultimate temptations.
Really good, Swami. That's really good.
Sometimes we speak of temptation and lust and greed, but sometimes the temptation is just not being fully yourself and trying to. Yeah, to wear someone else's mask or life or whatever, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, even, I don't know how much this language comes up, but if you're familiar with the Enneagram, I'm an Enneagram 4.
I'm a 9.
Okay. Oh, okay. That makes a lot of sense. That's good. 4 to 9. This is why we like each other. It's a good combo. Mm-hmm. As a 4, I spend, in theory, or so the theory says, I spend a lot of time seeking my own authenticity. Hmm. But the thing about each one of us, our own authenticity is utterly and completely unique to us. So even in that quest, I am still looking at other people's perfection as a model to find my own authenticity. Hmm. It surprises me how much it's a continual learning and unlearning to let go of the quest to master someone else's dharma or someone else's perfection, right? Like for me, I love Richard. Richard has never asked me to be Richard. Richard is always, he makes fun of my hair and fashion a little bit, but for the most part, there's a lot of love in that. And he encourages me to be me. What a gift. What a gift.
Individuation, right?
Yeah.
Mike, speaking about what we spoke about, Richard, your podcast with Richard, Everything Belongs, but you are very soon beginning your own podcast. Maybe by the time I'm sharing this recording, it's already out there in the world. So The Healer with 1,000 Faces. So yeah. I don't know if you would like to share some thoughts. What took you to making this podcast, and what has it been to interviewing different teachers and people that you brought to this conversation?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking about it. You know, the whole thing started before the podcast. So my background, again, is comparative religions, comparative mythology, and Jungian depth psychology. And so I studied this through my PhD, and Joseph Campbell was a big part of my journey. He wrote a big and very influential book called The Hero with 1,000 Faces. Yeah. It's not a perfect theory, but his idea was looking at similarities between religions to find wisdom for how we undergo the task of sort of what he called the hero's journey, which is living a life, the heroic task of becoming who we are. Mm-hmm. And what happened for me was, after doing all that study, you know, in my work for the Center for Action and Contemplation, I want to say, between the podcast and rebuilding the Living School, I've probably recorded 300 conversations with spiritual teachers in the last 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, we got a chance to ask people about their journey. And it was in the middle of one of those conversations, literally, we were talking about the hero's journey, and I just kind of said it. I said, you know, I don't think I want to talk about the hero journey anymore. I think I want to talk about the healer's journey now. Because I think what's far more interesting to me than just the heroic quest of figuring out who I am is also this idea of in that, you know, working on my own healing and then putting my healing in the service of healing the world. Mm. But it started with that idea of, gosh, what does it look like if I... And I was talking to one of my friends and mentors, Carmen Acevedo Butcher, who's another teacher that I hold in such high regard and have learned so much from. And I'm so grateful to be closely connected to. And I said, you know, Carmen, I feel like we take this journey, we seek the medicine that we need for our own healing, and then that medicine becomes the medicine that it's ours to uniquely give to the world. And she said, yes, Michael, but also we become the medicine. And I thought, gosh, that's fascinating. So I had this idea, you know, and as I've described, this pattern kind of emerged for me that, you know, all of us have wounds. My wounds are unique to me. They can be in dialogue with your wounds. Your wounds are unique to you. And those wounds are part of what sets us out on our wandering and shapes the unique life path that we take. And the wounds give us our wondering, the unique questions that are mine to ask and answer. Jung says that the generations before us hand us their unfinished work, and they give us questions to try and answer. And that's been true for me. And then that wandering and wondering leads us to our unique wisdom. And again, my wisdom different from yours, and yours different from mine, but that's our wisdom to share. And then that leads us to our work. And that's where we put our healing in the service of healing the world in exactly the way that is ours to do. So I really kind of was taken with that. And I thought, well, let me make sure that's actually true, right? Mm-hmm. I love the idea. It sounds a little bit poetic to me. But why not, you know, take some more time to talk to a few more of my friends, mentors, and teachers and ask, has this pattern been real for you? And how have, you know, your wounds shaped your wandering and wondering and wisdom and work? So then that's what became the Healer with a Thousand Faces podcast. So I've right now recorded about 14 episodes. We'll see if I get them out in the world before this drops. I'm making it a real low stress project, but it's been really rich. I've learned a lot.
Wow. Thank you. I was remembering while you were telling all this, a few words from Henry Nouwen when he gives the analogy of Jesus with the bread, like the bread is taken, the bread is blessed, the bread is broken, and the bread is given. So he makes a parallel how we are being taken by God's love, we are being blessed, we are broken, and in acknowledging that we are given. And when he speaks about the brokenness part, he will basically make a case that, yeah, our brokenness also makes us who we are, and in the uniqueness of who we are, not to over-identify only as broken, but just to acknowledge our brokenness in connection to healing as a defining feature of our identity, so to say, like something that allows me to individuate and allows me to be the unique individual that I am. So,
yeah, it's so true. And I think just to connect it to what we've already been talking about, I think it's so often the things that we think of as our imperfection that actually end up being the source of our beauty and our unique wisdom. I think perfection is boring, to be honest.
I totally agree with you. In my recent book, I basically speak about that, like promote something that I call spiritual imperfectionism.
I love it.
Counteract so much millennia of spiritual perfectionism.
Oh, I love it so much.
I'm getting neurotic in the name of the love of God, and I'm daring to be imperfect for the love of God.
That's wonderful. And I mean, and I think really the only way to do it, that's I'm so captivated, you know, in every tradition with the tricksters and the holy fools and the folks who really are not afraid to get down and dirty. Carmen Acevedo Butcher, again, our mutual friend and teacher, says everything worth doing is messy, right? She says, if you're going to cook in the kitchen, if you're going to make love, if you're going to create art, it's always messy. And I think the same thing is true for spiritual practice and the quest that we're on in seeking the love of the divine.
So like vulnerability is a preliminary necessity for any genuine project and step in life in terms of messiness, because to be vulnerable means to be raw and naked, basically. And
it's so true. I so appreciated when you and I spoke the other day, and I was talking about moving this idea for me, where I was like, I want to shift away from hero to healer. Mm-hmm. And you shared some things with me about the notion of hero in your own tradition that were so enlightening.
Hero means we call Nayaka. And actually in our tradition, it's interesting because the ultimate reality is depicted in as a drama. Like I said, divine drama. So in every drama, you have different characters, and traditionally, okay, there is the hero, but an indispensable quality of the hero is vulnerability. The hero has to be wounded. And even, of course, at different levels of wounding, we didn't talk about that the other day, but even in our tradition, we will not only talk about our wounding, or as in the Christian tradition, of course, Jesus representing this universal scapegoat, as Richard will put it, and embracing that wounding. But even we'll speak about, to give you an example, like Krishna, God, engaging in romantic divine love and being wounded by the arrows of Cupid, poetically put. But there is some type of wounding affected by love, like someone vulnerable, someone who is hit by love, who is affected. So, for a hero to be a hero, that person must be open to influence, vulnerable, so to say.
I love that so much because there's, you know, you and I talked about this. Invincible heroes are not interesting. Mm-hmm. And they're also not people. They're archetypes. They're not real. I struggled, you know, growing up as a Christian, I initially really, really struggled with the way that Jesus was taught to me, because Jesus was always taught as being perfect. And it just didn't give me anything to relate to. There was no traction. I couldn't grab any hold on that. And then there was this image that was always shared of someday in paradise, Jesus will be there with us. And this is in the scripture. And in paradise, Jesus still has wounds on his hands and on his feet. And I was always taught, and those wounds are there to remind you, anyone who knows this particular Christian system will understand what I'm saying, that you're sinful and Jesus was wounded to pay the price for your sin. And one day I came to realize that I think what that image was telling us was that in paradise, wounds are beautiful. That's what makes it paradise, is that we're able to see the beauty in the wounds, right? Not guilt, just beauty. And so I so appreciate what you're saying, Swami, because it gives me this whole other level of insight that a true hero is vulnerable and imperfect. Oh, that's so good. Yeah.
There are wounds in eternity, and they will be beautiful.
Yeah.
Gosh, yeah, I would say that even those wounds will be seen as ornaments, even. Mm. Yeah, as a decoration, so to say, something that beautifies the experience in that ultimate reality. And somehow I'm relating all this briefly, if you allow me to go there for a minute, regarding this article that Richard shared with me and with you and probably with everyone, erotic decisions.
It
speaks a lot about risk taking in love. Yeah. And it's very related to this idea of entering the messiness of life and acknowledging our wounding and even being open to the idea of wounding in eternity.
Yeah.
Which again, for some may be like, I don't want to go forever to a place where there will be ongoing woundedness.
Yes.
Even if it's beautiful.
Yeah. Agree.
Not like risky, you know. So, but at the same time, risk taking in love is You cannot have genuine love if there is no sense of some type of risk taking. And I remember talking our conversation when we were having lunch in Taos, and I shared this with the author of this article, Erotic Decisions, and we depict the ultimate love with God as extramarital love, which is clandestine, is secret, is going in the underground, implying all the risk taking that is involved, and I'm risking all my position and fame in society, and I may be defamed at any moment, but I'm just fully for that clarion call, that divine call, and call beyond duty, so to say, something beyond, like a metaphor for divine intimacy and passion. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So many. I'll try to be brief. But you know, we have that in the Christian tradition, as I know you well know, because we've already talked about it. But that in the sacred text of the Song of Songs, where you have these lovers who are sneaking out in the middle of the night, you know, having this sort of, you never really know, is it an illicit love affair? What's the cause of it? But it's a real Romeo and Juliet. They're having to sneak around to be together, and they love each other so much. And then they have rendezvous, and then sometimes they're interrupted, and then they find each other again. And for thousands of years, mystics in all the Abrahamic traditions have looked at that and said, that is a metaphor for how the soul loves the divine. That sort of rapturous, overwhelming longing that'll bring you into the love lost and found and lost and found again. But it is interesting. I will say this parallel thought. As I've sat with this whole idea, you and I talked about this the other day, of the hero with 1,000 faces, and realizing that our wounds drive us along. I've realized after talking to these teachers that the idea was incomplete, because it's also our wonder that calls us in onto our path. Those moments that wonder breaks in. And in some ways, Swami, I think that wonder can actually be more terrifying than our wounds. Because wonder is, it's sometimes wholly unfamiliar.
Yeah.
It cannot be captured or controlled by the ego.
Yeah.
And it is always leading us into the unknown. It's always asking us to step off the map.
And I cannot avoid thinking about something that I generally teach and say and write about, which is, and I think maybe we talked about this or not, but regarding what you mentioned, wonder can be more terrifying even than our wounds, because it's unknown. And I always like to talk about our potential. In our tradition, the soul is described as a unit of potential. So we have an ever-evolving potential, but also, if wrongly expressed, we have an ever-devolving potential, and we can go in. But we may be terrified about our brightest potential just because it's unknown.
Yeah.
Like, we don't know what's that about. Just being put in a situation that is beyond our measuring standards and controlling mechanisms, it's terrifying.
It's absolutely terrifying. And it's an interesting, I've watched Richard sit with this. You know, he started saying, the second season of the podcast was the first full season. It was the first season we worked through one of Richard's books. Mm-hmm. And in the very first episode, he did a conversation with Brené Brown. Mm-hmm. And he threw this phrase out. He said, I've been thinking a lot about how love is walking the plank. He's like, love is always walking the plank. It's stepping off the plank into the unknown, and it's the surrender of control. It has to be. And then he's followed this line of thought to where he encountered this idea in this article of making an erotic decision, a decision driven completely by Eros. And the first time he shared that with me, he said, I think about everything in Cincinnati is going really good, and I pack up everything I own into my little pickup truck, and I drive to Albuquerque to start the Center for Action and Contemplation, having no idea if it's going to work out or how it's going to go, but it feels like what I'm supposed to do. Like, I can't explain it. I can't make it logical. I just know. I feel that erotic draw, Eros, leading me forward. It's terrifying and beautiful.
Again, we need to resort to paradox. As I like to say, paradox holds the most truth.
Yeah.
Whenever we don't go to paradox, we lose half of the equation in one direction or the other.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
Something can be terrifying and beautiful at the same time.
Yeah.
We're invited to follow that call. Yeah. And I appreciate that you quoted Richard, and you made the point of the word surrender and walking the plank, because For our traditions, surrender is basically the foundation of our life of bhakti or devotion. Mm. Our teachers will say, bhakti, devotion without surrender is imitation. It's not the real thing. It's surrender is the inner substance of a life of loving dedication, basically.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And I think for Sufism and Islam as well, like, surrender is such a powerful spiritual teaching, and it's terrifying. It's terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking with a friend of mine that we were talking about. I'm a sannyasi or swami, another word in our tradition, sannyasi, like renounced monk. And one of the main attributes of vows we make, actually, interestingly, because someone may think it's celibacy or whatever, but that's mostly thought as a byproduct of the main stuff. And the main stuff in Sanskrit is called abhayatva, which means fearlessness.
Mm.
So in connection to all that we are talking now, fearlessness, like trying to be okay with uncertainty, with the unknown, not constructing a life of comfort and security and certitude, which, as Richard will say, certitude is the opposite of faith, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think about even what you were saying about potency and potential, or the fear and the wonder, the fear of our own potential, right? Mm-hmm. Those moments where love or life asks us to take a risk that is a stepping into our own calling, our own potential. Hang on one sec. Can I have 3 seconds to grab a book? All right.
Sorry, Swami, I'm leaving you on the air.
No problem. We are looking at your beautiful bookshelf, meanwhile, no problem. We are examining your titles.
All right, we'll see. I might not be able to find it. There is a book. Drat. I can't find it. I'll get it for you.
There's a book by Abraham Maslow called The Further Reaches of Human Nature.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, he has an essay called The Jonah Complex. We talked about this the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at the biblical story of Jonah. Mm-hmm. And he says that one of the things that we're most afraid of is our own potential and our own goodness. In our moments of peace, when we are most aware of our own wholeness, and then what could happen if we step into it, that scares us more than anything. He says we're more afraid of our potential and our goodness than we are of our darkness and our challenges, which is wild to think about.
Yeah, yeah. In my forthcoming book, after the one I recently published that I almost finished with, I quote something. I don't recall the name of the author. I think it's Marianne Williamson. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But she says something very similar. If you just get to have that Maslow's quote, please, I wouldn't get angry if you share that with me.
100%. Yeah. It's over there.
No rush. Not now. Not now.
No, yeah, I know. Later. I know.
Because I may include it in the book as a reference. But
100%. Oh, I would love to. Not now. Yeah.
So my going back to, again, love, risk-taking in love, you were speaking about how to make some connection between my bhakti tradition and Christianity, Christian mysticism in particular, these dynamics of union and separation, longing and reunion. And let's go for a moment also to some of your favorite ancestors, your love for Origen. Can I share a quote that I put from Origen in my recent book, Evolution and Divine Love?
Oh, I love that there's a quote from Origen in your book, please.
Of course. And I will read it just to see your face and reaction, please.
I love it.
Because I'm talking here about, based on his commentary on the Songs of Songs that you just referred with, and he speaks about this loss of, this cycle of losing oneself and separation from God only to be found. So it's just one paragraph says, this cyclical process of being lost, found, and then lost again, and of course, then found again and so on, beautifully illustrates the dynamic nature of spiritual progress. Origen teaches that the soul's quest for divine union is not a linear path, but one marked by alternating periods of intimate closeness with God, followed by periods of seeming separation. Mm-hmm. These oscillations reflect the soul's maturation, where each phase of feeling lost or distant, quote unquote, is essential for growth and deeper self-awareness. A refinement of the journey. Every renewed experience of finding God leads to a more profound and rich union.
Yes.
According to Origen, this ongoing journey is characterized by an ever-expanding recognition, I like to make that separation in the word, recognition of God's infinite mystery and the soul's persistent longing to embrace the divine in new and transformative ways.
So good.
I want to see your face now.
Absolutely. No, that's perfect. I love it. It's one of my favorite ideas that Origen gives us is this.
And now I understand why Origen is your favorite one.
Oh, he's so good. Hang on one sec. All right. This time I am going to grab a book and I know where it is. I'll be 3 seconds.
No problem.
I love that idea so much. There's a passage, you know, Origen was writing at a time where people didn't really share too much autobiographically. But there's a passage in here where he's talking about just that. And he says, he's talking about the Song of Songs and it's the lovers who are always finding each other and losing each other. And he says, talking about bride and bridegroom, and he writes this. Then the bride beholds the bridegroom, and he, as soon as she has seen him, goes away. He does this frequently throughout the song, and that is something nobody can understand who has not suffered it themselves. But God is my witness that I have often perceived the bridegroom drawing near me and being most intensely present with me. Then suddenly, he is withdrawn, and I could not find him, though I sought to do so. I long, therefore, for him to come again, and sometimes he does so. Then when he has appeared, and I lay hold of him, he slips away once more. And when he has so slipped away, my search for him begins anew. I love that passage. That, to me, is the spiritual quest, because I think for those of us, particularly, and I know there's more than moments of rapture and you know, mystical experience and divine intimacy, but we've had those tender, precious moments where we feel connection, right? And then we lose it. You know, life gets in the way, or tragedy happens, or we get distracted, or there's taxes or bills or fireworks, whatever it is. But then the search begins anew. And that notion that the search begins anew and it just draws you deeper and deeper and deeper till eventually you realize that, you know, there's divine love even in the losing of it. Yeah, I don't know. I get really excited about it.
Since we are exchanging books, that what you just read resembles so much to this part of our tradition, cool. Which is, I told you, there is this ultimate depiction of transcendence like a divine circle dance. And I won't make too many connections now with the Trinity and perichoresis, because that will be too much for that circular dance and celebration. And in this tradition, in this story, quote unquote story, which for us is the ultimate reality, Krishna, the divine God in romantic love, calls his beloved. They appear. He calls them with the flute. He tells them, what are you doing? It's too late. You go back to your home. And they're like, you called us. Why are you sending us back? So stirring the heart, right? Union, separation. And they start to argue with him. They finally stay. They start to dance and sing and celebrate life. And at one point, he disappears. Yeah. And all of them go crazy looking for him, looking for signs in nature, imitating him in divine madness. And he's hiding, looking at that. And they start to sing in dying separation of him. He eventually reappears. And they continue dancing and celebrating on a new level, like the whole reunion became upgraded, and so on and so forth, ad infinitum, basically. Yep. Right?
I love it. I love it. I love it. And I think that's the, you know, that I don't know if it's a wiring thing or personal experience or what it is, but I know when I've encountered those ideas and those descriptions of the divine, it's the most sanity-making invitation for me. Because that's, you know, what a beautiful dance to be a part of, and how reflective of reality, you know, that we just wind in deeper and deeper, and you know, and again, even in the losing it, we're finding it.
Thank you. Just Mike, we have a few more minutes. I'd like to talk with you, since we talk about someone you love first, Richard, now Origen, and so many other people you love. I'm sure you're a great lover of reality. Let's conclude with one another people you love, Carl Jung.
Oh, right? God, I love Carl Jung.
You have a background in psychology, mythology, religious studies. So how do you see Jung's relevance for spiritual seekers today, especially those disillusioned with institutional religion, but still deeply longing, as we were just talking?
Yeah, you know, Jung, I think, in the last century, did what Origen was trying to do 17 centuries before that. And there's a connection. Jung was the one who led me to Origen. He quotes Origen over 100 times in his collected works. But what Jung did was I want to grab another book for you. And I'm like, where is it?
That's the danger of doing a podcast with your bookshelf behind your back.
I know. There's a really, well, I'll say this first. Jung was able to look at the containers of religion and recognize where we confused the containers for the contents. And he was willing to encourage us to look past the container to what it was containing. To quote Joseph Campbell, who's a student of Carl Jung, he said a lot of us treat religion like going to a restaurant and trying to eat the menu instead of using the menu to order the food. And so Jung, you know, there's a really, really beautiful passage in the introduction of one of his works on alchemy, and he's talking about the Christian tradition. And he says, if Christianity is to meet its high educative task, it must begin again from the very beginning. And he says that the challenge of Christianity is not seeking new theological truths, but of recognizing that they are dealing with people who have eyes but do not know that their eyes can see. And that the task is not to give people new ideas, but to teach them that their eyes can see and teach them how to see. So
learning how to see, like the podcast by McLaren,
that podcast is titled on a conversation he had with Richard, where Richard said, we don't need to teach people to truth. We need to teach them how to see. And Richard was quoting Carl Jung when he said it. It's just like,
and in our tradition, generally the term to refer to enlightened beings or sages is Rishi or Tattva Darshan, which means seers of reality.
Yeah.
It's always tied to the notion of, they have learned how to see.
Yeah.
Probably learning how to see also is acknowledging what gets in the way of the seeing, right? And in this connection, I'm thinking of Jung and his notion of the shadow.
Yeah.
Right? Like we will say famously, when an inner situation is not made conscious, it appears outside as fate.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yes. Why is this happening to me? And we don't realize that we're actually making it happen. So first of all, you know, the word contemplation, story for another day, is connected to theoria, to this idea of seeing reality for it is, and stripping the illusions. And Jung said, stripping our illusions feels like dying.
Oh, yeah.
It is one of the most painful things we experience, to have those illusions stripped away and to confront reality face to face. And he said that a lot of organized religion functions to protect us from a direct experience of God, which is so it doesn't kill us or shatter us. Honestly, it's not necessarily as bad as it sounds. But that stripping away to reality, that polishing the lens. Origen says we sink our mind into our heart and we look there for other eyes. That's the quest, right?
That's a necessary dying before dying, right?
Yeah. And so what had happened with Carl Jung, I heard one author, John Sanford, I think it was, who said that if you look at Jung's work, he had this journey that I appreciate. His father was a parson, his father was a minister, but he couldn't relate to his father's faith. His mother was a sort of a mystic who would engage in seances and other things, but she was also in and out of mental hospital, struggled with a lot of challenges. And Jung was trying to put those two things together. And he went out, he studied yoga, he studied Hinduism, he studied Buddhism, he studied Taoism. That gave him a lot. And then at a certain point, he thought, I need to heal the tradition of my culture. And so he returned in the second half of his career and wrote a lot about Christianity, myth, and symbol. John Sanford said he refers to Jung's whole psychological enterprise as Carl Jung's treatment of Christianity. He said he was trying to treat the whole religion of Western culture as a patient that had become sick, and he was trying to rehabilitate it. So Jung's work has been really, really influential for me in both, helping see reality as it is, see the truth in so many great traditions in their core. And then two, recognize where, you know, the culture that I live in has become neurotic, where it's forced so many of us to shove the good parts of ourselves into our shadows. Mm-hmm. And it's separated us, the very eros that we're talking about that lets us walk the plank, that lets us make an erotic decision. Western culture tries to program out of us. And Jung was really helpful in psychological language about talking about how to bring that back in. Mm-hmm. How do I get in touch with the parts of myself that I've lost? How do I get in touch with the passion that I've lost? How do I get in touch with my inner divinity, right?
Yeah, I cannot avoid thinking about Jesus' phrase, like, love your enemy. And in this case, the enemy, true enemy, is the parts that we have exiled, right? The shadow.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
Love your enemy. What does it mean when the enemy is within and this is the part that we have exiled? So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a great quote from Jung where he says, you know, I'll love the, in the name of Christian kindness, I will love the beggar. But what happens when I realize that the beggar most in need, how does he say it? That I am the beggar most in need of the alms of my own kindness. He says, then at that point, we cast that person off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I like to say, loving everyone includes myself. So loving the beggar includes a recognition of the beggar inside of me, because love has to be loving in every possible direction.
Yeah.
Simultaneously.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And the flip side is true. What keeps it from being narcissism is when I'm loving the beggar inside of me, it helps me love the beggar and everyone around me. Mm. That's so beautiful.
Mike, as we wrap up, can I conclude our conversation with a section that I like to invoke sometimes, which is just a few brief, spicy questions where I will expect from you a similarly short, spicy answer.
Sounds great. I'll keep it pithy.
Yeah, the premise is short questions, honest answers, no overthinking, just your gut truth.
And let's do it.
And fasten your seatbelt just in case.
All right.
So number one, which is a teaching from Richard that you return to again and again?
The two most primary paths available to us are great love and great suffering.
Which is a phrase in the religious world that we wish we would retire?
For me, sin. I think sin needs to be retired and rediscovered as sort of woundedness
missing the mark, the original meaning.
Yeah, missing the mark, absolutely. Yeah, missing the mark is a good one.
Aim again and shoot again. You have many arrows to continue.
Yeah.
Which is one shadow that you have learned to befriend?
Oh gosh, the part of me that likes to be colorful, and to love the fact that I like to be colorful. It's okay.
It's clear that we have befriended that one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is a sacred text or passage or myth that undoes you every time?
The Ramayana.
Oh.
Every single time. Wow. I love that text so much. I read a new translation of it every other year.
Wow. Lots of crying if you really get into that text. Lots of drama.
Yes.
Which is a spiritual cliche that actually proved true in your life?
Oh man, that's a good one. Healing people heal people, hurting people hurt people.
Which is one moment of rapture that became a portal?
As my mother was dying, my brother's widow gave birth to their child, and holding her hand changed my life.
What does everything belongs not mean to you?
Acceptance is not approval. Everything belongs does not mean everything should stay exactly the way it is.
What are you still unlearning?
Everything. I am still unlearning that when I experience great love in my life, it doesn't mean that I need to go out and prove myself worthy of it.
Two more. If you could give a one-line benediction to a generation in spiritual burnouts, what would it be?
Rumi says, I know you're tired. Come, this is the way. Yeah.
And the last one, who is God for you today?
Oh, you.
Today.
Now today. Let's see. Who is God for me today? You in front of me talking to me. Amelia sitting over here listening. My cat out there on the porch. And love.
Yeah.
so showing up in all those places.
Okay. So, Mike, I'll love to end with this. The short questions are over, but you conclude with the word love. And in one of our conversations, Richard described the spiritual journey as learning to let God love you. So how are you learning to let yourself be loved today? Not as a teacher, as a director, as a theologian, but as Mike.
I had a Zen teacher once, and she told me, she said, Zen is just being in the moment. That's all, being fully present to what it is. But she said, that's what Zen is. But she said, but then sometimes we lose the moment. And Zen is also noticing when we lose the moment and just coming back to it. But she said, eventually we learn that everything is Zen. And so losing the moment is also Zen.
Everything belongs.
So, everything belongs. So for me, it's the moments where I feel anxiety, the moments where I feel anger, the moments where I feel frustration, the moments where I feel incomplete, realizing that, you know, when I am weak, then I am strong.
Dear brother, thank you so much for joining us on Conversation. And it's always a pleasure to meet you, and looking forward to the next one.
Such a gift. This is so great. Please, let's do it again. This is wonderful. And I'm so glad that you're doing this and getting your wisdom out in the world. Thank you, Swami. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.